You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and eagle-eared listeners will have noticed already that my voice is wrecked. They'll have looked at the calendar and they'll have thought, oh, Stu's been to Glastonbury. And yes, I have. I saw almost no music, as is my as is my taste. I spent most of my time in the theatre and circus areas watching some brilliant comics. I comped the cabaret tent on Sunday for Alex Adelman, Tiff Stevenson, Alistair Barry. All did very, very well, and I'm looking forward to welcoming them all to the show at some point. And also, you know, my tastes have sort of leaned towards the esoteric. I also very much enjoyed The Wheel of Fortunes, which is 5 or 6 or maybe 3 guys dressed as the Red Power Ranger spinning a wheel and DJing and doing stupid, stupid stuff. They're kind of like the DJ equivalent of Goldie Looking Chain. They were great fun. And my all-time favourites, one of the funniest acts at Glastonbury, the brilliant Bramble FM radio, so local you can smell it, which is, there's no point me describing it. But if you've seen them, you'll know who I mean. And if you haven't, then those are the people you should be racing to get Glastonbury tickets for and not jumped up rappers. So much as I enjoyed his first song. So, right, now to business. Right, I'm looking wistfully in the distance now, remembering what a lovely festival I've had. To business, and my God, there's a lot of business coming up. In the next few weeks, I'm going to be interviewing Justin Morehouse, Matt Kirshen, Deliso Chaponda. If you listen to this before that one comes out, if you're listening to this any time in the first week of July, you can still get tickets for my live podcast with Deliso Chaponda at the Darlington Comedy Festival, so have a Google of that. I'm also, who have we got? I'm trying to get Mulaney. Loads and loads of you are emailing me going, Stu, Mulaney's in Soho, get Mulaney. I'm doing my very best. We'll have to see how that works out. Also, I mean, God, they're coming out of my ears. There's two biggies that aren't 100% confirmed, so I won't tell you those. And I'm very lucky to have recently booked a couple of extras for, who did I get in for Edinburgh? I've got someone great on board for Edinburgh. I wrote them down. Oh, for heaven's sake. Sorry, this is unprofessional. This is very much the sort of thing I should already have sorted out. Who was it? I'm excited about it. I made a little note. It is Will Durst. Oh my God, we've got Will Durst for the podcast. Have a Google of Will Durst. He's been around forever. Like, he influenced Bill Hicks. So, sorry to have momentarily forgotten that. So remember, the Edinburgh lineup currently is Catherine Ryan, Secret Biggie, Will Durst, Stuart Francis, Secret Biggie, Aisling B, Daniel Sloss, Jason Byrne, Joel Dommett, Mark Steele, just got Mark Steele confirmed as well, Ronnie Cheng, and then the all-important five question marks on the final show for someone that I'll decide when I'm up there. So those are all the Edinburgh things. You can go to edfringe.com and search for Comedians Comedian Podcast. Come and see me up there. This is the longest intro I've done, and you'd be right to think, get the fuck on with it. And I will do that now, because today we have, live from Durham University, not from the university itself, but it was organised by Oscar Karonka at the university, thanks to him. We've got Gav Webster. He is one of the most... I won't do a big introduction, but listen, Gav is one of the most frequently requested guests from this podcast. I've had so many emails, get Gav on the show, and you're about to find out why. He won the Comedian's Comedian Award, nothing to do with me, but a brilliant award kind of created not by the industry, in inverted commas, but by actual comedians, not in inverted commas. where comics vote for their favourite circuit comic each year. And he was, I think, the first or maybe the second winner of that award. And very much deserved it was too. This was recorded live at The Empty Shop on Framwell Gate Bridge, which is a great little kind of artistic cafe place. Hello to the guys that run that. They were lovely guys. This is Gav Webster. Let's get stuck in. Here's Gav. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Gavin. Let's start with the award that you were nominated for and won. Was that the first year of the awards?
No, it was the second year.
Yeah. And whose idea was it? Did John Maloney start it?
It was John Maloney who had the idea and he started it off, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it was voted on by something like 180 professional
something
comics.
Something like that, yeah.
And you won because they all voted that you were there for... It's sort of like an unsung hero of comedy.
Yeah, I don't know how I don't know which way it played out. I don't know what the percentage was, but I think people got a choice of two or something like that. Or you got a choice of five or something. So it was like the Finnish system, or I don't know what it was. Some form of democracy. I don't know, but it was a choice of five. So I don't know exactly how the results panned out, but yeah.
But you won.
Finished top, yeah.
I don't know how the results panned out, but I finished top. What did it mean? What did it mean to you?
Brilliant. Yeah, definitely. Great. of course it was. It was fantastic.
Okay. And did you anticipate that you were someone? I mean, your place within the comedy community is such that you're one of those acts. Like, you're a very frequently requested guest on this show, and I think you're recognised by a lot of comics. You're heralded by a lot of comics as a comedy inverted commas genius. Like, people really like your stuff.
Well, I don't know. They may just be paying lip service. I don't know. You don't know, do you? You don't know. People always say nice things to you, whatever you do, and you don't know whether they're just saying it or not. I don't know. It's nice to be popular, but you don't know how popular you are until you maybe get an award or something, then you. Well, not an award as such, a recognition from your peers, I suppose.
Yeah, it's arguably the best award a comic can win, I'd have thought.
People said that, and I think I agree with them, yeah. But you don't get a house out of it, do you?
So tell us, whereabouts are you at the moment? You're going to Edinburgh this year?
Yes, I am, yeah.
And what's this show called?
The show this year is called The Sexist Sexist.
You have got a bit of a habit of provocative show titles.
Yeah, well, this one's in keeping with the award because it was the Comedian's Comedian. So this year I'm going to have, going to give myself some unwanted awards that I didn't want.
Okay, previous show titles have included All Young People Are Cunts.
That's great.
Bill Hicks Wasn't Very Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't Give Money to Comic Relief. Which was your first one?
And Other Opinions.
And Other Opinions.
Don't Give Any Money to Comic Relief and Other Opinions, yeah.
Which was the first provocative, deliberately provocative? Because honestly, they're the titles that make me laugh out loud. Every year when I open the Fringe Guide, one of the things is, what's Gav called his show this year?
the first provocative one was All Young People Are Cunts. back in 2011.
And what motivated that? There must have been people saying to you at the time, oh, I mean, that's funny, Gav, but you're not really going to call your show that.
Well, I had a song called that, and I recorded it, and it never really worked live, you know, because I thought it was a funny title of a song, but I thought it would be in keeping with a bit of anger about about how shallow a lot of young people are. And while it was on, there was the riots in London. And a lot of comics, and they'll remain nameless, said, oh, it must have been brilliant when you did that show because the riots, it coincided with the riots in London with all these young people looting shops and things. And you could have just walked on stage and went, there you are. But it's the actual opposite of that. I was bemoaning the fact that young people had no spark in them, and I thought this was quite good that they were having riots in London, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So people were actually doing something as opposed to being passive.
That's what I thought. And if there's any complaint I would have about young people why I did the show, and there's a lot of young people here today, and I'm sure you'll probably agree, actually, is a lot of young people have got no edge about them at all, and they're very keen to get a credit card at the age of 18 and get a mortgage. And I'm not saying that people didn't do that before, but it's trying to have a trying to put the cat amongst the pigeons with the writing and have a provocative title to boot, and try and challenge people, which is what I think you should do in Edinburgh, to be honest.
When you're thinking about challenging people, how much, like when you're writing a show, how much of it, and not just a show, when you're writing, let's go back, right back to material in general, it seems to me that a lot of your material is kind of based in, I don't know, for me, you're a conundrum, because you've got the persona that you do in your comedy when I see you doing 20s, you've got, you know, it's just jokes, it's wahai, it's kind of like... It's kind of like, how would you describe it? It's a sort of like a barroom kind of, or like a music hall kind of.
Music hall, yeah, very good.
It is, it's like a kind of a...
Crash Bang Wallop music hall, yeah.
Absolutely, so you're opening by going, these are, I'm so tempted to try and do your accent, by the way. But, you know, you're going, these are just jokes. Oh, I wrote that one myself. Yeah. You know, you're doing little kind of kind of music hall-esque banter with yourself.
Yeah. But, you know, you're slightly sending it up, you know.
Yeah.
I think intelligent people know that you can... is a favourite phrase of critics, and it's see things on two levels. If, like, some people know that you're taking the mickey out of that music hall style, but then other people see it as just good jokes, you know. That, like, if you look at the old music hall acts from many, many a long year ago, some of them pre-war, but definitely a lot of them post-war, some people would say they were surreal, but that was before the word surreal was in vogue.
Yeah.
It was just good jokes, you know.
And I suppose what I'm getting at is there's an interesting dynamic there between the kind of friendly, daft jokes approach and your actual anger and your wish to engage with actual real things in the world.
Yeah, well, it's good to have the two working on the two different levels at the same time. It becomes less one-dimensional, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah. So prior to seeing your show titles in Edinburgh, and prior to kind of recognising that provocative element in you, like in preparing for this interview, mm-hmm. and you've been recommended loads, I've seen you be brilliant in clubs loads, I've worked to get with you in London here and there, mm-hmm. I suppose I didn't realise that there was so much kind of passion in what you do, besides the passion for being daft.
Well, I still like to make people laugh. That's the underlying trend. Still want to make people think it's funny, but I think if you can have polemical points, but still be doing it throughout the humour all the way through, rather than, I don't like that kind of comedy where people get a bit self-righteous, and there are comedians that would say, well, I'm going to say something now, you're not going to like it, the women aren't going to like it, and I tell you what, some Christians are going to get upset by this, and I tell you something, I'm going to say something and not everybody's going to get it. And you think, just say it. Just say what you've got to say, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like they're apologising for what they're going to say. It's a bit of a repressed, maybe an English thing or a middle-class thing, or it might just be a kind of a suppressed and repressed, which is a sort of similar thing, isn't it, in a way? Like you've keeping a lid on it, you know, or you haven't to put barriers around it, you haven't to explain why you're going to behave in a certain way, but you should just do it. There's nothing wrong with being a bit schizophrenic in your style or your act.
So let's talk about how you brought yourself to comedy in the first place. What were you like when you were a young person? Were you, I'm desperate to ask, were you a cunt? Were you passive as a young person?
Yeah, I was quite quiet, relatively speaking. Had a lot of the outgoing character sort of knocked out of us. Not physically, just by virtue of where you're from and the background, the school you go to and the area you're from, and probably the era of when I was brought up had it pushed out of you a bit.
What, you had what pushed out of you?
A desire to be innovative and interesting and passionate about, I don't know, intellectual things and having an interest in something not of the ordinary and... you know, just generally outgoing, because you have to step into line, where in the area that I'm from, really, I suppose. So it's difficult to step out of that.
And did you find that you managed it as a kid, or did you have that perpetually taken out? Like you said, beaten out of you. I mean, it doesn't mean necessarily physically.
Yeah.
But when did that, I mean, was that sort of bubbling away under the surface? Did you have any outlet for it as a kid? Were you making your friends laugh? Were you being daft as a kid?
In small bursts, but it was always kept down by teachers and parents and other kids as well. And it wasn't a time to let yourself go like that. So you would have it in your mind that you could maybe think about that later, but not while you were at school.
And did you have any allies in that at school? Was there anyone else? Like, I think back to, like, I didn't enjoy being at school at all, but there were one or two friends that I felt like I could have that little buzzy connection with. It was like, we're going to get out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you said that, actually. Yeah, there was one or two. And you realise when, I don't know what the equivalent is for young people now, but when I was brought up, the Viz comic was coming through. And when you realise, when you get older, when you realise that the Viz comic was selling 1.2 million in the early 90s, something like that, everywhere there's an outlet for people who want to see interesting stuff and hear interesting things. And then when years later, I was on building sites and in factories, and then you realise there's a large minority, there's a section of blokes who you get told on like that, but love Monty Python and things. And you realise there are more people out there than you'd think that like alternative human, you know, slightly cultish things. And
yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, in the way that people, and the way that men in particular, sometimes men, young men or old men, whatever, you sort of perceive people in the street as being aggressive because they're walking around with this front on the whole time because they're scared of being perceived as weak.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But so then you're in a city or wherever where everyone's walking around with that front on of like, I'm hard. And then as
a vicious circle.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle whereby no one actually... So it could be that that's a really good point about Viz. Loads and loads of people were buying that and laughing at the vibrating bum-faced goats.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's ludicrous stuff.
Yeah, and it wasn't just performing arts students. It couldn't have had that number if it was just, you know, very bohemian people. It was plain old Joe Smiths and all that were liking it. And my missus loved the Viz, and she, on the surface, just looks like a... You know, and sounds like the epitome of what wouldn't like the Viz, you know, things like that. So you realise that there are other people out there that would like the same things.
How much of your act, and let's talk about your early act, how long have you been going? 20 years or so?
23 years altogether since I first got up.
Okay. How much of your act was influenced, that kind of music hall influence? How much of that is as a result? I suppose I'm asking about my own prejudice here. I'm asking about my own ideas of how your act might have been developed. But how much of it is a response to working in tough environments? Like, you're very, very punchline heavy.
Yeah.
You've got lots and lots of short jokes. And you know what I mean? I sort of feel like you're one of those acts who, you know the word bombproof? It's kind of bandied around. Do you know what I mean? You go, someone who definitely, like, whatever happens, however rowdy it is, this person's going to turn up and go bang, 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 bang.
Yeah, well, that comes partly through background, but then you read things and you hear things later that apparently the opera was like that 200 years ago, you know. That,
the
like,
opera?
Yeah, apparently. I'm thinking of
Is that why it's so loud?
Yeah, that they would say that they would have a loud bit at the beginning because people would fall asleep in the opera. It sounds like a late show at the Comedy Store or something.
Yeah,
opera,
right, you know, okay. Like
people would... it's the oi polloi that were there. If that's the right frame of people. Yeah, not it wasn't the... Because now it's a snooty thing. It's just changed hands. It's just... The rich sometimes get a hold of things and run with them and then say that you're not allowed to have it, but then it swings back and forth, doesn't it, really? But apparently the opera was quite... populist, I suppose, back in the old days. So you've got to run against that. So yeah, punchline heavy to keep people's attention, and it's probably a little bit it's a little bit of a coward's way out in a way, because what you're trying to do is keep people on side. Whereas some comedians I've admired a lot like Paul Foot or something for going on and doing what he wants to do. It doesn't matter how many people he loses. And I really admire that, actually.
Yeah.
Whereas I've tried to keep people on side a bit whilst doing the more interesting things to... But then you get other comics who just want to just kowtow to any audience, you know. They've got no backbone whatsoever.
Absolutely.
Know?
I remember when I started, I just thought the name of the game was just make them laugh.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
However, whatever it takes, just make them laugh.
Fair enough.
And you can end up down the line going, oh, yeah, I'm really good at making this audience laugh. And then go, oh, God, actually, you take a look at yourself. God, I don't respect myself at all.
Yeah, and it only gets you so far, doesn't it? Yes. I think.
So this is Gav. We'll get right back to him in a moment. Just a couple of your emails I'd like to read out. Bit of correspondence. Now, this will reward you for being a long-term listener of the show. But do you remember the Nick Doody episode sometime last year? Nick talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect. And Nick, as someone who is sort of very, very, very intelligent and a chess grandmaster or submaster or something like that, a submaster, that's unlikely to be the term, but he talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect. And there was a point of clarification from a listener, Stefan, who emailed in to explain this clarification. He says, what the Dunning-Kruger effect applies to is two different sorts of people. This is a mathematical effect, but we're using it within comedy. It says, in the case of comedy, it means shit acts who think they're phenomenal and brilliant acts who feel like frauds. And he says, brackets, I'll give you a moment to think about that, seeing as the second half of that sentence describes nearly everyone who's appeared on your podcast, including you. You're very sweet, Stefan. However, this is the whole problem with people's self-perception. If you think to yourself, well, I don't think I'm a shit act who thinks they're phenomenal, then you think to yourself, well, I must be a brilliant act who feels like a fraud. I mean, hey, I feel like a fraud all the time. Great. That means I'm brilliant. Oh, no, that means I'm a shit act who thinks they're phenomenal. So, I don't know. He goes on to say, what's the trick to being a happy comedian? If you're brilliant, you'll always think you're not good enough. Well, that's, let's hope we all fall into that category. He said, the healthiest thing you can do, even if you're category one, imagine that you're about average. As Sarah Pascoe says, be happy to be mediocre. Don't pressure yourself to be the best, because you'll never know if you're the best. Well, I think that's a great recipe for a happy life. But is a recipe for a happy life the same thing as a recipe for an ambitious career full of success and plaudits and all the sorts of things that comedians want? I mean, you know, who amongst us can really pursue what I think of as the sort of the Phil Kay path of going, no, it's about the art. I'm going to do this and not care about anything else. You know, it's early in the morning. I've had a coffee and I'm starting the day going, oh, right, what is it? Oh, self-perception. Listen, I'm going to go to Manchester now and I'm going to interview Justin Morehouse. Can't wait to bring you that one. So let's leave that where it is. Any further thoughts about Dunning-Kruger, feel free to email me info@comedianscomedian.com. And a quick email from Tom in Berlin. This is lovely. I can't not mention this. Tom's into the show. He's teaching circus. He's laid up with an injury. He started getting into the show. He started writing stand-up. Very excited. He is number 20, I think, of people the podcast has not created, but let's go with created, but not created. He says, side note, and you'll like this comparison. With the amount of people I know who listen to this show and then go on to perform, I think in 4 to 5 years you'll have guests coming on who started because of the show, basically like RuPaul's Drag Race has now. So well done, Stu. You're the RuPaul of stand-up. Mate, I mean, you know, if you listen to the show, just how excited that makes me. He goes on to say, I'll donate. Listen, a lot of people say this. He says at the end of his email, I'll donate when I'm not broke. That's totally cool. And that's completely taken for granted. You don't have to say that. Thank you to everybody that's donated. And thank you to everyone for being so polite and saying, oh, I'll donate when I get the chance. I'll donate when I've got a bit more money. If you can't afford to donate, you don't have to donate. If you can afford to donate, you don't have to donate. It's just for people who want to. There's no obligation whatsoever. I would hate to think that any of you felt obligated by my frequent solicitations to donate money to this show. But if you enjoy the show, if it's made a difference to your life, if you can tick all of those boxes and the final boxes and you can afford it, then please do donate. Go to comedianscomedian.com, click on the donate button, or if you're on that newfangled Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/comcompod. But please don't feel ever that you need to apologise, or someone pressed a fiver into my hand and said, I'm sorry, it's not more. Don't be sorry. It's so great. I appreciate it so much. And the people who can afford it, they pay for the people who can't. And occasionally people do that. I had a really disgustingly big donation about a month ago from someone who, by the sound of their address, us can certainly afford it. So if you're one of those people, the onus is on you, my friend. You support the show in the manner that you see fit. And remember, if you've got no money, you can support the show in loads of other ways. You can give me a 5-star rating on iTunes. People are still doing that. That's a thing everyone mentions in the first 10 episodes of their podcast and then forgets about. You can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. That's great for visibility. You can share your favourite episodes. You know, grab one of the SoundCloud files or a link to comedianscomedian.com and share it on your friend's Facebook or email someone. Or even better, have an actual conversation about the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. These are all great ways you can support the show. So don't think it all has to be money. Please don't ever apologise if you can't afford it. Ladies and gentlemen, you can also, finally, I will get back to Gav. I just wanted to very quickly mention, you join the Facebook group. I'm finding it very, very useful to have a dedicated core of ComCom listeners on the Facebook page. I don't know the thing offhand, but if you're on Facebook, you can find it. The Comedians Comedian Podcast group. There's about 2,300 people on there now, and it's really good for me floating little ideas and testing things. We've got some ideas for T-shirts. We've got some merch on the way in the pipeline. And I've been able to say, which of these 6 designs do you want? Oh, clearly that one's the front runner. So that's really useful to me. Plus, I try to reward people on the Facebook group with little advance warning of things, little pictures of guests and what have you, clues and stuff like that. So do join that. That'll do us for now. Thanks for listening. Let's finish off this conversation with the brilliant Gavin Webster. What are the phases of the last 23 years? What are the kind of... Was it like... I was talking to Will Anderson recently, an Australian comic, yeah. And he was talking about how he's been going 20-something years and the first 13 of them, he didn't really know what the fuck he was doing. He hadn't really found his voice, you know what I mean? And that, yeah. I thought it was a brilliant admission. That was very candid. Yeah. But, like, what were the phases of your career? Was it, like, you know, 5 years' worth of swedging to try and get... make a living from it? Or what... You know, what were the kind of the corners? Uh-huh. What were the kind of the...
The footnotes.
I don't think I mean footnotes. What do I mean? The... anyone? The bits in between the thing. Milestones. Same again. Milestones. Thank you very much.
That's a good one, yeah.
What were the milestones? What were the differences in flavour between the different things of that over such a long period of time?
Well, it was quite surprising when I first got into comedy because I sort of got into it by accident, but then... started doing it, and I thought, like, because I like Monty Python and things, but I also thought that stand-up comedians, you know, people like Billy Connolly and that, and then when I went on the circuit, I thought, oh, well, it'll be a lot of people doing observations, that's what it'll be. And then I realised, I think we were going through a period in the early 90s of it being a bit, it's gone back over, retrogressive, because it was more people doing gags, if you like. Mm-hmm. But it was like in a postmodern ironic way, wasn't it? That's what it's supposed to be. Because people were framing it up as an observation because it was the first person, but turning it out to be a joke.
Can you give us an example?
Frank Skinner, obviously Harry Hill was just a surreal one-linerist, but say Frank Skinner's a good example. And even Joe Brand and even observationalists like Jeff Green and people like that. If you looked at them, the sort of leading lights of the team, they were really doing punchlines. They were setups and punchlines.
Yes.
And I got the impression that they might have had good intentions before, but then they turned it into setups and punchlines because obviously in the early 90s, the comedy clubs started to rise up in London and, mainly London at first, but then obviously it came out of London, and it was very joke based because you wanted to get audiences on side. Same thing is what's always been the case. Whereas now it's gone a different way now because there's a generation passed since them days, and a lot of young people see comedy as observations. Really, I think and I think that's just a very narrow style of stand-up comedy, but some people see that as what it should be, just observations. Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, it's gone a little bit... It's become a bit testosterone-fueled, weirdly, because I think a lot of people see it as young men talking. You know, because there's a lot of young men get up and just talk, and it's a bit dull, I think, personally.
This is something I see... on like Facebook forums with headliners who've been going 20 years
right.
on them, whereby there's a kind of a, that's like a conversation I see all over and over again of people going, oh, I remember back in my day, you used to have to have jokes.
Uh-huh.
You used to have punchlines.
You know, and the people that sort of echoing that sentiment of just going, nowadays it seems like you can just talk about something that happened to your friend.
Right, that's a big political football with it, isn't it? About how your mate's mad or something like that, or how your nan's racist and then just do some racist material. And it's an excuse to do that. And then people say about how their dad's mad. And that's a weird one because you just think, well, just get your dad on. It doesn't really... And it's a bit sad that a young person's got to go on about how their dad's crazy, and you feel that there's not an eternal rebellion anymore because their dad would be around in, you know, well, for young persons in their mid-20s now, their dad would have become a dad in the about 1980s. So their dad was probably a young man in the early 80s and things. You think, well, you'd like to think that people have moved on from celebrating what their dad was like.
What is it about that? What is it about that kind of the, not specifically the dad observation, but specifically about younger comics? What is it that are those things that are pissing you off? What is it that's, I'm not trying to sort of entrap you, do you know what I mean? But like, what is it that is annoying about that compared to what you think comedy should or could be?
Well, sometimes I'm a bit annoyed with myself because who am I to say that comedy should and could be a certain style? You know, who am I to say what comedy could and should be? You know, there's everybody in this room has got an idea of what they are like, but you know, who is anybody to say it? And it all should be like that, you know, like,
yeah. I do know what you mean, and I think we'll put the rest of this conversation in brackets, or you know, we'll put a footnote saying Gav accepts that, who is he to say? Yeah. But I would like to hear your opinions on it. Because I think as someone, you're placed as someone who's seen it develop over so many years and has got very strong feelings about it. Like, I know in your blog, you're very opinionated about comics, about other comics, about styles of comedy.
Yeah, I did. Well,
and I would like to direct listeners to your blog. Because
well,
your blog,
I saw I don't do the blog so much now. And the reason why I stopped it is people got upset. A lot of people did from a lot of walks about what I said about certain tones, you know, and God's sake, you know what I mean? Like, you know,
it's so refreshing to read someone going, "Oh, this such and such a compare was a bit shit and ruined the room." Do you know what I mean? And you just think, no one does that. Everyone's so guarded.
Well,
now,
that's what I thought would be a good thing to do. And some people really took to it. I got massive amounts of hits, but then some people got upset, and then other people, there's certain comics, sort of famous ones, apparently don't speak to me for what I said, and I've checked what it is I'd said about them, and it was really mild. You know what I mean? I'm not going to say who it is, but I said, I was on the television and establishment comedians, so-and-so, so-and-so, and somebody else were on, and one of these establishment comedians has obviously objected to me using the word establishment comedian. And it's only a bit of fun anyway, but like, how can you get upset by that?
Why do you think they were upset by it?
I think because when you get a bit of fame, I presume it's the same in pop music as well, you're surrounded by these leeches and that are just telling you how good you are. And if anybody says anything mildly bad about you, I think they'll learn 30 years in that you've just got to take it on the chin. But they don't like it, you know what I mean? They don't like that kind of... They don't like anybody scrutinising them or having a go or...
Or do you think it might be that within the bubble of London that there's a sense that you can still be kind of outrageous and carefree as a comic, and it's only actually when someone observes that from the outside and says, no, actually, you are part of the establishment. You're not as punk rock as you think you are.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what it is, to be honest with you. I think, you know, you get a lot of knocks, don't you, when you do Edinburgh, because you get some terrible reviews. Everybody does, you know. And then people make comments about how bad you are, and there might be other comics. There might actually be critics masquerading as members of the public or whatever, but you do get hit a lot, you know, and you've just got to learn to take being hit. You know, that's what you've got to do.
Is it particularly frustrating to you, do you think, to be hit, as you say, in that way, given that the way that when you were a younger person, you felt like you were having creativity beaten out of you?
Yeah, it probably reminds me of that a little bit. And it reminds me of the jealousy a bit, you know. You know, a posh person with a pen has the same issues, I think, as a bricklayer who doesn't like you using long words. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
They may be completely different class-wise, but I think they've got the same problems.
What are those problems?
They just don't like somebody else being able to have some wit that they haven't got, I think. Because I'm not just talking about me here, by the way. It sounds a bit egotistical. Just anyone. You know,
That's all right. Refer back to the footnote. Gav's not talking about himself. he doesn't consider himself worthy of a position on this, or, you know, who knows.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But I noticed, like, you banned a particular comedy-related website from coming to see your show.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm just interested in that because, like, I would always roll my eyes at any kind of review. Any review that's kind of less than a 4 of me,
yeah.
I'd look at and go, oh, fuck. I'd either go, fuck, this person's an idiot, they don't know what they're talking about. Or I'd go, oh, God, they've seen right through all of my bullshit and they know exactly what I'm doing, you know. And I'd have some reaction like that. It would never occur to me to go, that's it, you're not coming in. And I really like that. I really admire it. It seems like with the blog, it seems to have that, oh, God, there's someone who's telling it like it is. I don't know if it's because of your origins. I know you came to comedy through a sort of a sense of excitement that it was a bit punk rock.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That you wanted to go, this is attitude, this is me, this is who I am.
Absolutely,
on the inside.
Yeah.
So
there's no career path back in them days, you know,
you had to do it because you loved it.
Yeah, that's
you didn't
right.
Do it.
That's right. That was the difference, I think, between then and perhaps now.
So when you banned a certain website from coming to see your shows, did you feel like, oh, I might be shooting myself in the foot down the line? I think a lot of newer comics now would be very afraid to make a move like that.
They would,
thinking,
yeah.
Like, oh, God, what if such and such doesn't like me? You know?
Absolutely. No, not in the slightest. Might have thought that 20 years ago, but not now. No, 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 not at all. It felt really good doing that. It's fantastic. It was... It's Chortley's talking about, by the way. In case nobody knew.
You said on one of your blogs.
Did I?
You said,
oh, no, I'm getting quoted now, but because I've written.
The whole London
feel like an MP now.
The whole London set involves constantly going to the right parties, associating with the right people, kissing ass and sucking cock. But I wasn't playing. Next morning after doing the show, you were talking about Does Doug Know?
Oh, yeah.
Next morning after doing the show, I was on the train home or going off somewhere else to do a gig.
That's right, I did have
a gig. Do you think that that's still the case? Is your view of how comedy works, that it's about having an influential agent or sucking
cock
after?
You've got to play the game a bit, yeah. You do have to play the game, but... But then, you know, is perhaps... Is Stuart Lee playing the game by not playing the game, if you know what I mean? You know that thing about Bill Hicks where they said, like, he said, if you're in advertising, kill yourself. And they said, oh, yeah, I see what you're doing. You're playing the part. You're playing the card of being totally against advertising. That's good advertising, Bill. You know that kind of
sure.
So almost by not playing the game, Stuart Lee's in the game, maybe. I don't know. You can tie yourself up.
Yeah, absolutely. He sort of positioned himself in such a way that he gets to comment on things.
That's right,
results, I'm sure, in an enormous amount of tickets being sold.
That's right, yeah. And then this, the same time, the free publicity comes in from, I don't know, the Guardian and the sort of the left field saying, oh, well, this is a bloke who's anti-comedy, so we'll get this anti-comedy person to have a column every week or whatever, and then you suddenly can position yourself from that. Said, can't you?
So do you think comedy is a meritocracy?
To an extent, but mainly at the bottom. I think if you're good, you'll get gigs. And then if you're good, you'll get better gigs. But then later on, it's more... I think agents over the last 30 years have got a hold of it and they've turned it into something where... It's fashionable who gets on and who doesn't, and they've turn it their way. But like how Simon Cowell's done that with music. If you look at the history of popular music from the early 50s with soul and swing and the country style, and of course it gets mixed into rock and roll, and then the youth movement, the beginning of the teenager, if you like, from right through to the present day, which is what, 60 years on, it's been a battle between the Simon Cowell-esques of this world to kind of manage these people and be at the very much the ones who the movers and shakers, the ones who say and do what goes to
set the agenda.
Yeah, to set the agenda. Yeah, to the ones that have their own directorial control. And it's been an intriguing battle over the last 60 years, but I feel these people have finally won now.
Mm. And do you
same with comedy?
And you think that's the same with comedy?
Yeah, I think it's almost gone back full circle to what it was back in the 50s and the, I don't know, the Bernard Delfont, Lord Lou Grade days, right through to what you've got now. That the big agencies have, I mean, they're not all bad, the big agencies, but I think they now have, you know, they set the agenda a lot more.
How are you? Where are you in the creation of your current show? Have you got your hour, or have you got some of it? Whereabouts are you? Let's just sort of broaden it a bit and talk more about where you are in terms of writing at the moment.
I'm about a third of the way through, I suppose. Yeah.
And is that an appropriate place for you to be for your own kind of happiness at this time of year? Is that about normal for this time
I'd
of year?
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you feel about it? Are you shitting yourself about the other two thirds, or are you feeling like I can do this?
No, it'd be all right. It's sort of, it's a bit like cooking a meal or something. It's not like, it doesn't just rise up on the plate and then finish at that level. You're doing all sorts of things from different angles, and there's physical stuff I want to hold up and things like that, and a bit of music in it. That's not done yet, but the stand-up bit that I'm working on, the talking, is largely done. Well, it's halfway to being done.
And talk us through how you write from scratch, from the end of last year's show and going, right, I've got to write a new hour.
All right, yeah.
What does that look like? Are you typing? Are you putting pen to paper? Are you thinking about stuff in the car? What does it look like when you write?
Well, I think of ideas, and I tend to go to rehearsal studios and talk to the wall.
Do you really?
Yeah, that's what I
No one said it. That before. I've tried doing that once and it was a disaster.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was horrible. I couldn't get over how weird it felt. It was far too big a studio.
This is weird though, isn't it?
Yeah, this is weird. This is weird. That's their fault.
I think it's weird getting up in front of people at a gig, really, to talk to a bunch of strangers and just start talking about what you think. I think that's weird in itself. So I just thought, what's wrong with just going into a room?
Yeah,
I get a microphone. I hire a microphone there and put the amps on. So it's.
Do you really?
Yeah,
that's fascinating. Yeah. Honestly, 120 really? Something shows in. No one's ever said they've done that.
Have they not?
No, right. That's great. That's called the Webster technique from now on. I like it.
It's always it's First Avenue Recording Studios, Heaton, in Newcastle.
Okay,
do it, and I've known them for a long time, and I tend to go in there and do 2 hours. And
with notes beforehand, or just going
sometimes
on and just
notes, sometimes not. You sometimes just start talking, and maybe do a bit of your set and start talking as though you're in Edinburgh. Or I tend to do a show once a year at in Newcastle at a theatre, and I'll just start talking. And there's always something comes up, and there'd be a note, some notes like you've got on the table there now, and then I just think of something and think, oh, that's good, and I'll write that down, and then I'll start talking again, but put that note that I've put in and had that to it. Just keep talking and keep talking. And I think that's the most natural way to make it look conversational and good. And that it seems like it's off the top of your head when it's not.
I love it. I can't believe I haven't been doing that myself. Like I said, I tried and it just, I just did my head in. It was far too big a room.
It's interesting you tried, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I didn't have a mic. Maybe that's the that's
yeah,
the problem.
It could be.
One of my most satisfying writing experiences was years ago when I did. I'm glad to not remember the name of Show Me the Funny, and sort of that TV show. And I found the whole thing really stressful and awful. But there was one particular day when I was just in a hotel room, and rather than sit and type in a cafe, I just got up and bounced around the hotel room for a couple of hours, just walking, sort of talking through it. Mm-hmm. And every time I did that, I'd add more to it. And yeah. I was like, God, of course, this is conversational. This is exactly how mm-hmm. it should work. What is it that you get out of, I would have sort of already said, but that making it conversational?
Well, making it like, it's not necessarily conversation, it's like a prose, isn't it? It's like you talk. It's not poetry, but it's prose, isn't it? It keeps moving, yet it's not. What's the word when you say a question but you don't expect an answer from it?
Rhetorical.
Rhetorical. Thank you very much. Yes.
Sorry, that is hilarious. You just asked that.
It's almost like it was a trick, that one, wasn't it? I'm not listening to you. yeah. It's not rhetorical, but it's also not too. That you're expecting them to come back with something. It's somewhere in between that. Because sometimes you can talk over punchlines, which is quite good. Sometimes you just make your voice go quieter while people laugh or whatever. Because mm-hmm. I imagine if you're rehearsing in your head, it's the same with all comics. You've got the laughter in your head, haven't you? It's a bit like if you write a sitcom, you're writing it and you're going, you are thinking of the laughter at that point. You're not sure. Thinking of like silence.
Yeah, that would be defeatist, bleaker,
isn't it?
Yeah, the already yeah. bleak prospect of imagining the gig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I heard a story about a comic, and I remember him. He's a nice bloke, and I heard this story second hand. I know this is a bit of an anecdote, but it's on the subject of what we're talking about. And this comic had like a sort of squeaky Cockney accent. And he did this. He was an awful act, and he did this thing where he was doing his set all there all the way through. Nothing. Silence from the room. Silence. No, nobody heckling. Just silence. And then he had this like really off colour punchline somewhere along the set, and it was the punchline was in. So I fucked her up the arse. And still silence, right, on that one. And then he went, yeah, I thought you'd like that one. Yes. Yes. You sick cunt. That's what he said. He's obviously rehearsed that line. And, oh, dear. So that's maybe why you shouldn't... do that narrative style in a recording studio.
But you've got short jokes. You've got the sort of short jokes after which you'd go, yeah, I wrote that myself. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. And those can't have just tumbled out of you in a rehearsal studio.
I don't know. Just to make a comment, just to make an editorial comment on your set is just something that's just evolved. Like, you know.
No, I mean, but the jokes themselves, the joke-jokes.
Oh, well...
That's got to be a sitting down and writing...
Well, you would think of them in the car or something, then you go and... Or whatever, and then you go and write them down, you know?
Yeah.
And you might write them down, yeah. But then it comes as part of the stream of consciousness after that. But it's good to get them in... To cement them into the set, because if it leaps out too much like a joke, it looks a bit, it jars a bit, you know.
Yes, I suppose that's that kind of framing device that you use of going, these are just jokes.
Yeah,
and this is, I wrote that one myself, and this is. But I mean, I saw a set of yours on YouTube where, like, I think the third joke is I've run out of material. I'm gonna have to improvise the rest. It's so funny, but that. Framing device of going, I'm just a bloke telling jokes, it sort of lets you slip in jokes.
Yeah, which it's sort of tricks, isn't it? Of like, it's a bit like, I thought it was Zen stuff when Ross Noble told me that Alan Davis, this is going back a long time ago, it's when Alan Davis wasn't massive, but he was on Viva Cabaret and things. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
And he said Alan Davis is like a genius because what he does, it is quite clever, this is, you go on, it probably isn't as amazing now, this, but at the time it was. He said he'd go on and he'd say, right, I'll start in a minute. When of course he started.
Yeah.
But he's telling you that he's starting in a minute and you're almost letting him get away with making like banal observations about the room and what's going on because he says he's starting in a minute when he actually has started.
Yes.
And I think like, Ross did a lot of that, and But it's you could be a bit uncharitable and say, well, that's just a trick of, it's just like a salesperson going around the doors trick of saying, yes, it's all right, I'm not a salesman or whatever.
Yeah, it reminds me of street performers getting out stuff, like playing music, chucking out some big metal props and stuff. Uh-huh. And going, ladies and gentlemen, showtime in 5 minutes. And you go, right. No, showtime now. This is just an uninteresting show so far. Yeah, that is absolutely true. Because then you see someone do it and go, oh, actually, they're funny from the off. Mm-hmm. And they're going, and they're setting up the expectation of being funny.
Absolutely. And it's just a trick. It's a show business trick that you do. It's a bit like asking how people are. Now, like, good evening, how are you doing? How are you doing, sir? And all that kind of stuff. And is this your wife? And it's all just tricks to get people in. And I know it's, that's a bit of an obvious one, but there is tricks and techniques. I once saw Bob Mills very early on, and he said, he commented on somebody going to the toilet, and he went, well, I'll just kill time till they come back. And he had material, which was kind of very childlike, silly material. And he kept saying, well, look, I'm just killing time till he comes back. And of course it's material, but it was more light stuff than the harder edge stuff before. And you go, that's a great technique. That's like, that's how you become a comic, not just telling people how your mate's funny.
So something else I think that you're really good at is getting the laughter up in the air in that way that you always think of someone like Ken Dodd, just chucks loads of little jokes at them until he works out what makes them laugh and then keeps them up there. Do you know what I mean? It's like he's playing keepy-uppy with them.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And
yeah,
I think you've got that. You've got such a good rhythm like that that you're really good at, because I don't know if it's because of the interjections or the little noises and the little laughs at yourself, like that music hall kind of style. Yeah. The rhythm keeps them up in the air the whole time. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it does. It's not so good if it's not working, though. Like, I think that's why I'm not like as fireproof as what you're perhaps intimating. Okay. Some people are really good at. Some people can do silences quite well. They can because that's another technique. Some people can do silences because the more narrative style people, because they can be saying, so I'm going to tell you this story, and it's an excuse for like them not getting any laughs, because they're just sort of saying, no, this actually did happen, and. In a way, it's almost an insurance policy, that one, saying, well, I know you're not laughing much, but this is... They wouldn't say that, but this is actually real. Yeah. Whereas if you were sort of doing gags at that point, you would be, like, a bit uncomfortable at the silences that you're getting from the audience, because you're not keeping them...
So do you have tactics for when a gig isn't going so well? Like, can you, like, what do you do? What's your kind of, do you have, like, fallback material or a gear change or go into the audience?
Yeah, I suppose
what do you suppose,
so.
What's your...
Yeah, but it's just bringing out material at a different time and a sort of damage limitation and just writing that one off and saying, well, I didn't do so well there. It's a bit of a downer, really, because you want people to really get into it. But I suppose in terms of, in the real world, to get booked again and to keep earning a living out of it, you have to do a sort of half decent job, don't you? To like go, I still did all right there, even though I was probably the worst out of the three acts in the comp there, but I was still all right. Whereas some people, when they're the worst act out of them, are awful, and they'll make sure they're not getting booked again.
I scored a small personal victory last night by having a gig that went really wonky, and looking back on it, I can sort of see why there wasn't a compare and there needed to be a compare. So I just kind of went on and launched straight into material, and they were a bit like, oh, we just want someone to talk to us. I realise in retrospect.
Oh, right.
But at least the victory for me was I came away from it and I went, well, at least I didn't do that awful thing that I fall into doing, of letting them know that I'm not enjoying it.
All right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, that's a real bugbear. Yeah. When I see other people doing it, I'm the first one to go, you shouldn't have said that. And I'm also the first one on stage to go, oh, you didn't like that bit, eh, guys? Do you know what I mean? In a way that doesn't help at all. You're trying to sort of acknowledge the
absolutely,
fact.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, learner drivers and stuff. You there's all these things you're not supposed to do, but you do naturally go into those, bad habits, you know, because... You know, after all these years, I still do bad habits myself. I'm not very good at struggling. I lose where I'm going and can't concentrate very well and make the same mistakes every time. And because it's not a very natural thing to be in front of strangers, not doing very well. You've got to think of something to get yourself.
It's that aspect of comedy that when it's going well, it just feels like the easiest thing in the world.
Absolutely,
you come off after a belter and you think, I should probably just sit down and write my next hour right now, because apparently I'm amazing.
Yeah, definitely. The amount of times that I think I finally cracked it. And what an idiot, you know? Yeah. Drive back home and you think, I've got this now. I really think I've finally got this. I think I'm perhaps the best act in the country now. And then and then when you go away and the downs are so far down because I've driven back from gigs going, I'm just not very good at this. I'm not relevant anymore. You know, you always get that conscience when you're older. I can't talk to people as well. And Matt Hardy, do you remember Matt Hardy, Australian comic?
I don't think so, no.
He was sort of around when I first sort of started. And he gave me some great advice, and he said, don't get too euphoric after you've stormed it when you're driving home. Don't do that at all. Just be cool about it, because when you die, you'll not be too bad about that. And the thing about being a circuit comic when you're not famous is the first petrol station you go to, the person behind the Perspex glass doesn't give a shit who you are, do they? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I've just stormed it in Salford. Yeah. And it's just gone, that's £20, do you want a receipt?
How do you cope with the negative aspects of the business? Are you quite happy? I know you've got a family, you've got a kid?
Yeah, I've got one daughter, yeah.
You've got a daughter. And do you, as someone who's like, I really want to have kids, I'm getting engaged, I'm sort of planning, come on, let's hurry up and have kids. And part of me is starting to go, oh God, this is going to be very different when I'm providing for other people.
Yeah. Yeah, because you, yeah.
Like, can you indulge yourself? Can you allow yourself to indulge, oh Christ, I can't do this? Those kind of like the long drive home of the soul when you've got to put food on the table.
Well, it does change the way you are about it a bit, but you're still only human as well, and you can't, you know, you can't put yourself through hell just to earn that bit extra, because obviously otherwise you would, you know, people would stop doing that job the lake at the circus and go and work in the oil rigs, wouldn't they? Because there's a bit more money.
I don't understand that metaphor.
Well, maybe there's loads of money in the circus these days. I don't know. Well, maybe a job you like you can earn more money doing that because it'll bring more money in for the family. It's not like that's not the be all and end all, is it?
So you want your kid to have a happy dad, basically.
Yeah, and to be there as well, that's the other thing. Sometimes I'm going to Singapore tomorrow, but I'm only there for a week. Mm-hmm. And some of the comics that have took 6 weeks, sometimes 2 months, sometimes more than that, aren't they? They're way down under and things.
Oh, yeah,
and they've got families, and, you know, I'm not talking about anybody in particular here, but this marriage is broken up and things, isn't there?
Yeah.
And a lot of it's just to do with not being there.
Yeah.
Especially with kids as well, you know, not seeing your kid for 3 or 4 months is a bit of a wrench.
I can't imagine doing that. One of my fears, I suppose, about the prospect of fatherhood is that as soon as I've got a tiny person that loves me, that's going to kind of be more important than smashing a gig in Salford. Right?
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
Gonna,
yeah.
It's going to be more important that I do well at the gig because now I need money to feed the tiny person.
Yeah. So it's a dilemma as well, because obviously you have to go out and earn money for them, but you can't be away all the time. But that must be the same in every walk of life. You know, you may be earning more money, but if you're not going to see your children.
I wanted to talk to you about Noel James, because I love Noel James. And I know in one of your blog or piece or an article you wrote, you referred to him as one of the greatest circuit comedians.
Oh, wow. Did you? I did, yeah.
This is the problem with the blog. You write stuff years ago.
No. Make it.
I'm a huge fan of Noel. I think he's just brilliant. Yeah, and I suppose he, because he's like a joke writer. Do you mean he's someone who's always struck me as getting it from a completely different place that I couldn't get it from.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, he's a terrific comic, still is, and I think a bit of an influence to a lot of people.
He's classic example of an influence. Not famous, doesn't have a high profile, known by comics. And even amongst some comics, he doesn't travel a huge amount. So
no, he doesn't.
You
That's
can
right.
find yourself telling people who Noel James is.
That's right, yeah. There's a certain generation or a certain comic that does certain clubs that don't know who he is.
What is it specifically that you like about his stuff?
Oh, the rhythm as well, and the style, and the contradicting the things that he's previously said, and the jokes, the plethora of the jokes, they're not just all play on words and they're not just all switches and pullback and reveals. There's every style of joke in there, you know. And I don't know if a lot of you have seen them, but it's got absolutely everything in there. And the attitude behind it, you know, because there's something a bit tat stand about him when he's up there and he's doing it to entertain the crowd. He's not doing it to kind of for you to get into his soul or talk about what he's about. It's just 40 minutes or 20 minutes or an hour worth of just brilliant material.
Mm.
And it's surreal, isn't it? It's bananas, isn't it? It's
off Yeah. I mean, this is the nature of the podcast is such that I can't really, you know, recite a bunch of his jokes.
It's not really fair.
But, you know, with a not recording device on, you can sit and do Noel James jokes at each other for an
you
entire
could,
car,
yeah,
journey.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So and some of it's got a polemic ledge as well. That's the other great thing. You know, somebody could be just being a bit of a clown, but they come out with a much more pertinent political point than political comics do, you know.
Yeah. So which piece of your material are you most proud of?
I've got a few that I do at the minute. I like, I've got a line that goes, and I'll tell you something else that pisses off my team of writers. That's one. And I suppose that's systematic of what's going on at the moment.
Yeah.
And another one is about how I'm quite sophisticated. That I would say that me and the wife, I like to listen to a lot of Radio 4. But with the sound turned off.
So let's just investigate that line for a minute, if you don't mind. Where was the idea from that? Where did that line come from?
Well, the last one.
Yeah, the Radio 4 one.
Well, it's putting on that kind of nouveau riche working class voice, you know, of like kind of trying to see a bit above everything.
Yeah.
You would think people would be impressed by, you would say, Radio 4, wouldn't you? But, like, the ultimate thing is people would, like... It's like people having things but not using them, you know, like...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I understand the joke, but where does it... Like, did that just come to you fully formed?
Yeah, that came to me, and that came to me on the nose. But the great thing about it was, the reason why I'm sort of explaining it, which I know you get it, is that like, it satisfies two things there. It's a sort of switcheroo joke, but it tells you about class and snobbery. I know that sounds very pretentious, but it's...
No, not at all, not at all.
It's about nouveau-riche snobbery, you know, because obviously a lot of people would like to tell you they listen to Radio 4, but couldn't be asked to do it.
Yes. You know? So it's a great switch. It's a great surprise.
Yeah, because it satisfies really... the need of a joke, doesn't
yes.
it? Yeah, because obviously there's only the one medium and it's gone, yeah.
Beautiful. Any questions from the audience? Is it just as feasible to be a working comic outside of a driving distance of London?
It is nowadays. It didn't used to be, but I think it's like the Arctic Monkeys, isn't it? You can do it from a provincial city nowadays, I think.
When did you think you'd found your voice on stage? And what does that mean to you? I always think, whenever we sort of talk about, like, finding your voice, I think that means lots of different things to different people.
Well, a long time, I think about 10 years or something. And I think you grow into it a bit, like, you know. When I started, I had ideas to say, I'll be deadpan, actually. And then I thought, I'll be a bit camp. And then you realise that you're not them things anyway, you know. Or you try to be something, or you try to be a bit angry, and you go, well, I'm not super angry. You're trying. And I think if people, when they eventually find their voice, it's no mystery that it ends up being pretty much what their voice is, you know. You go on a long journey and you've probably come back full circle again.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think it's about taking things out of your own way, you know, mm-hmm. rather than putting things on going, I'll be camp, I'll be like this, I'll be like this. You haven't got a choice. You know, if you want to be genuine, you just have to be the person you are when you make your friends laugh.
Yeah, because you aren't a character, are you? You're just an extension of yourself, really.
I'll ask you a ComCom Gold question from the archives to finish on. What would be your... do you consider yourself to be an artist or an entertainer?
Do you ask everybody this?
Not everybody. Some people. No, I ask everyone whether they consider Gavin Webster to be an artist or an entertainer.
And the results aren't back yet. That's a tough one.
But feel free to be pretentious. You know what I mean? You can consider yourself an artist without setting yourself up for an attack.
Yeah, I suppose you would, wouldn't you? Well, I like it. I think firstly, an entertainer, really. If you can't really ask for much more than that, really. Because you've got to entertain people, I think. But you've got to entertain them in your way. So that goes slightly towards art, doesn't it? Because otherwise, by what we said about nearly an hour ago, you're just crowd-pleasing.
Yeah.
So I'd say mainly an entertainer, but you've got to stick to your guns as to what you are.
And just as a last thing that I'll drop in earlier on in the interview, okay, the thing that I forgot that I was going to ask you before, this is my favourite question to ask people. If you were to review yourself, bear in mind what we've said about reviewers in the past, but if you were to sort of analyse yourself from an outside position, what things do you think you need to be better at? Like, what do you consider to be your strengths and your weaknesses?
I know what you're saying. I think if I was reviewing yourself, saying it's amazing how chaotically bad he can be sometimes. You know, on some nights can just look a little bit amateurish and chaotically bad alongside the good stuff. And it's weird, this, because when you say I can't get my head around why we'd be like that, but I'm talking about me, aren't I?
So stay with that for a second. I think that's fascinating. Where do you think that comes from, the propensity for it to dissolve into chaos?
Well, I suppose it's being like, I've always tried to be a good professional. I've always tried to be conscientious, but I think sometimes that can be really lapsed and bloody awful sometimes, because the nature of a laconic style you do drift into that area of being for brief periods. You could be bloody awful and people could be watching it and going, fucking amateur, this bloke, you know, he's terrible, you know. But then to counterbalance that, you can rise up and be fantastic, whereas I think a lot of competent acts could never do that. So it's the risk of being awful, but you can turn it into greatness, you know.
That was a great answer.
Was it really? I thought, oh no, it sounds a bit self-indulgent, that. But
no, I think that's absolutely right. It's about the willingness to take the risk. I think that's the thing we're all struggling with, whether we know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I hope at least I'm in the position where I'm aware of that, whereas for years I wasn't aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that, if you want to be really good, not just, like you said, competent,
mm-hmm,
not just consistently doing well in clubs, because mm-hmm, that's what we're all aiming for initially.
Yeah, we are,
you,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you want to be good in clubs, and you want to be so consistently good in clubs, mm-hmm, you make a living,
mm-hmm,
and then you've got to work out what the fuck comes next.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, good answer, Gav.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. No, we've got to wrap up. Gav's got to go off to, where are you tonight?
Jesterville in Gateshead Keys, doing this.
Lovely.
Show.
Have a good gig. Ladies and gentlemen, Gavin Webster. So that was Gav. Thank you so much to him for coming along. Thanks again, Oscar Karonka, for organising that at the empty shop. What was it called? I've forgotten again. The Empty Shop on Framwell Great Bridge in Durham. Thanks to everyone that was involved. Thank you to Nathan for co-producing the show. Thank you to Olivia Phipps for her constant podmin efforts. And thanks to you for listening. Do check on edfringe.com. You can get, you can't get tickets because it's free, but you can get information about coming to see all of those brilliant live shows that we've got coming up in Edinburgh in the last 2 weeks of the festival. Lots and lots happening underneath Black Medicine on Nicholson Street at 10:55 p.m. for the final 2 weeks. And my own show is going to be on at Cannons Gate venue, which, if you can correctly apostrophise Cannons Gate, then you're a better man than I. But come to that at 4:55 p.m. Definitely 4:55 p.m. Say it with me now. 4:55 p.m. Every day at Cannons Gate throughout the Fringe, starting on Saturday the 8th. So, come and see that stuff. That's my solo show. I'm really excited about it. And it is fractionally less giddy and with more written stuff than these bits where I chat to you at length.
Thanks very much for listening. Coming up next week, oh my God, there's still time. There is still time. If you get this quickly, there is still time to get your tickets. There's one or two tickets left for Adam Buxton on the 7th of July. SoHoTheatre.com. Enter the discount code FAF to get a discount for being a listener. And I will try and rush that episode out next week. If not, it'll be the following week, and maybe we'll have Deliso this week. There's just too much. There's too much. Shall I start doing it daily? God, imagine. I'd melt. Speak to you soon. Okay, that's it. Get the eggs. Get the eggs, that's right. Get in there. Chuck them. Chuck them in his garden. Get him. Get the eggs in there. Egg like an egg.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.